in the movie John Q. John Q is played by Denzel Washington. And if you've seen this movie, then you know how desperate he is, because in the movie, his son comes down with what they did not expect. His son has a heart condition that they find out about. And so they rush him to the ER because his son is dying. But John Q runs into some problems. He runs into problems because the hospital's not able to do much. The system won't help him. The hospital has failed, and insurance has failed as well. And so the character, John Q, takes things into his own hands, and he becomes very desperate. And he holds the ER kind of for ransom. I don't encourage doing that. But he holds the ER as a hostage until his son can get a new heart, because that's what his son needs in order to live. And at one point in the movie, he says, "I'm not going to bury my son. My son is going to bury me." Those are the words of a desperate man and a desperate father. And that's what we're going to see in our text today. In a very similar fashion, we're going to see a father who is desperate to see Jesus make a difference in the life of his life and the life of his daughter. And we're going to see a woman who is in extreme desperation as well. And it's going to challenge us and me and you to ask ourselves this: how desperate are you really? How desperate are you on a day-to-day basis when it comes to your faith? And how desperate are you for Jesus? In Mark chapter 5, starting at verse 21, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I want to show you how this entire section breaks down. It's called an ABA in grammar, okay? An ABA structure. And what this looks like is this: at A, you have Jairus' desperation. We're going to see this man who is in desperation to see Jesus make a difference. And on the way to Jairus' daughter, then we have another story. A story of a woman's desperation. And then the story comes back to Jairus' daughter being healed. Now, Mark has done this once in the Gospels so far. It's called sandwiching or bookending, and it's very intentional on the part of Mark to do this because he's trying to draw your attention to these two stories at the same time. And we're going to see that played out. And we're going to see how they both are two separate stories of desperation. And we're going to see how our faith and our story fits into that same account of desperation. Let's look at verse 21. What does it look like to have desperate faith? Verse 21. And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side. Now remember, he is coming back across from the Sea of Galilee because he had gone over into more of a Gentile area in which he ran into the demoniac who had thousands of demons as far as we can tell. And so Jesus demonstrated his power over demons and showing that he can not only exercise one demon, which we've seen in the Gospel of Mark already, but he can exercise multiple demons. So he's coming back from that event. The text goes on, a great crowd gathered around him and he was beside the sea. So again, maybe the crowd saw Jesus coming from a far way off in the sea, and they started kind of gathering around because they knew Jesus was coming back into the Galilean territory. Verse 22, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet. Now, who is this Jairus? Jairus here, it says in the text that he is a ruler of the synagogue, ruler of the Jewish synagogue. That means he's a very honorable character, isn't he? He has maintained this position for some time. And he is going to Jesus because he knows Jesus can make a difference. Now, when we read this text, this ought to create some really interesting bells going off in our head, because what kind of relationship has Jesus had so far with the Jewish synagogue? Not a very good one. In fact, the elites and the religious elites and the Pharisees and the scribes, they see what Jesus can do. And what do? They accuse Jesus of doing those things by the power of the Beelzebub himself, by Satan. So here's a ruler of the Jewish synagogue, though. He's coming up to Jesus and says, "I am at my wit's end. Do something to help me. I am desperate for you, Jesus." In fact, he is so desperate. Look at his actions. He doesn't just walk up to him and say, "Hey, you know who I am? I'm one of the rulers," right? He doesn't use his entitlement. He doesn't walk up to Jesus in some kind of professional, formal manner in which, "Oh, Jesus, I know who you are and I have a situation." No. What does he do? He runs up to him and says, "Jesus, I fall at your feet." This man is desperate, which forces us to ask, how desperate are we with our faith? Mark goes on, verse 23. Here's how his desperation pours out in verbiage. He says, "And implore him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be well and live.' And he went with him." That verse 24 says they're going now to wherever the daughter is. Look at the language that he uses. "I implore you earnestly, Jesus, because I know you can make a difference. I, in a sense, am expressing faith," because what is faith? Faith is belief in those things that are unseen. And he is saying, "I know you, Jesus, that you can actually heal my daughter because she is sick. She is really sick. And she is to the point of death." We even know this from the other accounts in the Gospels that this is his only daughter. So she is very, very, very special, isn't she? Here's our first point of what desperate faith looks like, is give honest requests. Give honest requests to God. He can handle it. Sometimes when we give requests to God and we pray, sometimes we feel like, you know what? My problems really don't amount to really big problems and big issues. So maybe he doesn't care as much about mine. Maybe my request can kind of be convoluted and not honest and open. But I encourage you, this man, this ruler of the synagogue, Jairus, he is giving an open and honest request, and so can we. Because this is what desperate faith looks like. In the book of Matthew, chapter 7, verses 7 and 8, we see on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus deals with prayer as well. He says, "Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks, and the one who finds, or the one who seeks, finds." Now, at this moment, we could probably do a 10-week series on prayer, but we won't. However, this coming summer, we will be answering some questions. And I think prayer is going to be one of those questions. What does it look like to give honest answers for us? It means being open with God. He can take your request. He can listen to you. He can even take your silly requests. Did you know that? He's willing to hear you out. Now, his answer might be no. His answer may be maybe. His answer may be not right now, but his answer may be yes. I bless you now. I kind of think the honest requests that I would like to see us have are the ones that we really don't want to make. Isn't that interesting? God, make me more patient. God, give me more self-control. God, help me to love that person that everything inside of me wants to hate them. See, sometimes we don't make those requests, but we can make honest requests. The story goes on. So we see there in the verse, in verse 24, and it's halfway through 24. Sometimes the way they split up these verses always frustrates me, because that's the end of that first section. Verse 24, halfway through, it says, "And he went with them." And now we'll pick up halfway through that at verse 24, and we call it B, okay, because we're halfway through the verse. 24b says, "And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him." Now, we don't use that word very much, thronged. That's kind of a strange word that ESV decided to use. But it means that the place is filling up with people. It's filling up quickly with people. I kind of think of a time lapse on a concert. Whenever a concert is a few hours out, you see a few people, but the closer you get to the beginning of the concert, you start seeing all these people kind of funnel in because the thing is beginning. Well, Jesus has been coming across, and now he's talking to Jairus, and now they're on the journey to help out Jairus' daughter, and the people are coming in more and more and more. Maybe it's because they want to see what Jesus is going to do. Verse 25, "And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but rather grew worse." There's our second person who is desperate. Jairus is desperate to see Jesus do something about his daughter. And now this woman who has come to Jesus in secrecy, she is certainly going to be hiding herself because of her medical situation. Now, her medical situation of one of bleeding for 12 years is a uterine hemorrhage, most likely, is what commentators say. And what's interesting about this medical condition is that, yes, it would be terrible to have this medical condition. However, that's really not the biggest picture here. If you're a Jewish reader of this time, and if you're a Jewish reader who knew the law back in Leviticus, you would know that this situation makes her ritually unclean. She is ritually unclean. This is a big problem, a much bigger problem than the medical problem, because this puts her out of community life. Because she can't touch things that are holy. She can't go to church. She can't go to the synagogue. And this is not because it is a sin. That's one of the things that I'm actually recently learning. The things with the law and the things that make people unclean is not always because it is a sin. It is just because that they're unclean and then unable to participate in religious life. And so because she has been bleeding for 12 years, she is constantly impure. She can't touch anything holy. She can't enter into the sanctuary, and she is isolated from religious festivals. She is isolated from religious life. She is isolated from the life and the community of others. And so here she is. She's not supposed to touch anyone, and no one is supposed to touch her, but she's going to go touch Jesus, the hem. Look further into the text. Look at verse 27. It says, "She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garments." Now, living in this community, do you think people knew who she was? You betcha. Look back at the text. She's got tons of people trying to help her. Look at verse 26. "And she had suffered under many physicians, and she spent all that she had." She has nothing to show for it. All of her efforts with all these physicians, nothing has fixed anything. So people know who she is. So she, I would bet, has covered herself up so that no one can see her, no one can recognize her. Because if she goes into a crowd, every single person that touches her becomes unclean. You see how a Jewish mindset would see this text? She's got to sneak there. And what does she say in verse 28? "For she said, if I touched even his garment," look at that faith. I don't have to talk to him. I don't have to make a request. I just have to sneakily sneak up. And I just got to touch. What faith. What faith to know that if I only touch, I will be healed. I will be made well just from his garments. Now, in Christian culture, this does not mean that garments are somehow special or anything like that. That's not the point that Mark is making. The point that Mark is making is the desperation that she has in knowing that Jesus can do something for her. The point in that what is special here is not the garment. What is special is Jesus. That's who is special. This desperate faith teaches us this, that we are to come to Jesus in faith. She is believing that Jesus can do something. And so even though it's kind of weird and strange for her to think, if I just touch the garment, but that's what's going to happen. She's going to be healed just by touching. Consider the verses on faith that we know. Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things unseen. What is unseen in her life is that she is not healed. And what is seen in her life is that she has a very serious medical condition. But she knows on the other side of knowing Jesus, she knows on the other side of Jesus doing something, I am better and I am healed. That's faith. 2 Corinthians 5:7, for we walk by faith and not by sight. Paul in Romans says, so faith comes from hearing, and hearing through the word of Christ. Have you ever been at a time in your life where you have thought, man, I need more faith? Have you ever talked to someone that was like, I just wish I had more faith. I wish I had more faith. Guess where it comes from? What did Paul say in Romans? Hearing his word. That's where we increase our faith. And this woman is expressing great faith in something that is not a reality for her yet. Not once Jesus makes a difference. Look at verse 29. And immediately, here's what happens when she touches the garment. And immediately the flow of blood dried up. And she felt it in her body that she was healed of her disease. She knows instantly. No one else knows except Jesus. We're about to see that in a minute. But no one else around her, all those that are touching her, all those who are becoming ritually unclean, they don't know what's happening. But she knows. And she felt the difference. And then in verse 30, and Jesus perceiving in himself, this is real interesting because we don't see this happen in the Gospels. And Jesus perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? I don't know how to explain how Jesus knows when someone has been healed because of him, but somehow he does. And I leave it to him to explain it to you, because I can't explain that one. But verse 31 goes on. He's asking, who touched my garments? And let's see the response. Is she going to speak up? Let's see what all the others say around her. Verse 31. And his disciples said to him, see, you see the crowd pressing around you. And yet you say, who touched me? Isn't that an interesting response from the disciples? They don't understand. And I'm with the disciples. I wouldn't have understood either. Like, what are you talking about, Jesus? Everyone's touching you. Everyone's around you. Interesting. Let's look back at verse 30. And Jesus perceiving that power had gone out from him. Look what he says. Who touched my garments? Jesus does not say, who did I just heal? Isn't that interesting? He says, who touched my garments? And then verse 32. And he looked around to see who had done it. You imagine you walking along with Jesus, you're going to go do something about this daughter. Don't forget, the story is actually about this daughter too. And you're following Jesus and you're walking along, and suddenly he stops and says, who touched my garments? And he's starting to look at every single one of you. I mean, if I was in the crowd, I'd kind of be like, I'm just going to look over here. Because I'd be like, I don't know what's going on. I'd be kind of freaking out. Verse 33, but the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear. By the way, came in fear. If she just touched Jesus and realized that she has been healed, guess what? I'm now going the other way, aren't I? And Jesus turns around, starts asking who touched my garment, so she might be 10 feet away. So now she's got to go confess and admit to what her secrecy has done. So she has to come back. And she's coming back in fear. Why is she coming back in fear? Because of societal norms, societal pressures. In this society, women are not looked gladly upon. And then a woman with her medical condition certainly would not have looked gladly upon, because she cannot have a family. She cannot have kids. And no one can touch her. She can't participate in ritualistic life. And this has been for 12 years. And so she comes back to Jesus because she came in fear. Maybe it was because she was doing it in secrecy. Maybe it was because she didn't, she expected to be healed and it happened. So she comes back in fear and trembling and she fell down. We have someone falling down again. Listen to the knees. She falls down just like Jairus. Falls down to her knees, trembling, and fell down before him and told him the truth. You see the desperation? It's the same desperation of Jairus. Very different person, very different life. But she is falling down in desperation because she has had faith and because she has been healed just by teaching Jesus. So verse 34, does Jesus now condemn her for doing such a thing in secrecy, for taking power that she did not ask for taking a healing that she did not seek out in the right way? Look at verse 34. And he said to her, daughter. It's a very personal thing, isn't it? By the way, he's going to heal a daughter and calls her daughter. It's wild, isn't it? Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Go in peace and continue to enjoy the healing that you have experienced. He doesn't condemn her. He doesn't say, how dare you? Jesus doesn't stand above her and condemn her and pull back. He doesn't pull back what has happened. He doesn't correct what has happened. Instead, he sees the faith that she had and says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. Desperate faith looks like this, you guys. Jesus disposes our uncleanliness. And it's really interesting in this part that she was ritually unclean. And if I, in this time, if I was a Jewish person and I was ritually unclean for whatever reason, and I walked over and me and John shook hands, right? Shake hands with me, John. Now, guess what? He becomes unclean because I was unclean. That's how everything worked in this time. So she touches him. Does Jesus become unclean? Not at all. See, Jesus doesn't become unclean because he is the one that can cleanse us. He is the one that can cleanse us. And no doubt, this is the one, this is a text that is echoing Isaiah 53, 3 through 4. Look at the promise in Isaiah when he says, he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. This is Isaiah talking about and prophesying about Jesus. Like one from whom people hid their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. Now look at verse 4, especially thinking about the context of what this woman has experienced. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. Now, at every point in the gospel text, I feel like when Jesus heals someone, we could always talk about healing. And here we do believe that God can heal anyone and everyone. But remember, when the gospel accounts are talking about healing individuals, like healing this woman, or healing someone who is deaf, or healing someone who is blind, we always realize that that is talking, is giving us a shadow of things to come. Because the things to come is that everyone, everywhere will always be healed at some point. That's ultimately what we look forward to in every insight, in every picture that we have that Jesus does of healing, is a reminder that one day he's actually going to fix it all and there will be no suffering. That's what we look forward to one day. So what does desperate faith look like? At the beginning, Jairus gives an honest request. We learn that we can come to Jesus in faith, and we have learned here that Jesus disposes our uncleanliness. He wipes away our uncleanliness because of our faith in him, because of his grace, because of his atoning factor of what he did on the cross. So thus far, here's where we are at in the story. So has anyone kind of thought of, hey, how's Jairus doing? Wait a minute, let's put ourselves back in the shoes of Jairus. Jairus has run up to Jesus. He has fallen down to Jesus' feet. And he is now saying, come and heal my daughter because she is sick. And so Jairus is sitting there walking with the crowd. But suddenly there is a priority interrupt. And Jesus stops the Jairus journey to his daughter and then talks to this woman. And Jairus has got to be sitting by the side going, hold on, wait a minute. You got the time? I mean, my daughter was close to death. We got to get going. Jesus, we can't sit here and meddle around with a woman who is ritually unclean for 12 years, and she can't touch anyone or touch anything. You imagine Jairus' thoughts? Jairus has got to be thinking, wait a minute, I'm the ruler of the synagogue. How dare you stop for someone so unimportant? Couldn't you have come back? Jairus doesn't make any of these claims. He realizes, though, that he might have to struggle with this some. We realize that in this story, Jairus, and it's not written, but he's got to be sitting back and going, hold on, wait a minute. I thought we were going to my daughter because she's almost dead. But we're going to learn that Jesus is not distracted. Jesus is not taking this lightly, but instead Jesus is going to take not only the opportunity to exercise his authority and power over disease, but he is also going to have the opportunity to exercise his authority and power over death here in just a minute. But you can imagine Jairus sitting back and going, come on, it's about time to get going because my daughter's about to die. Let's look at the bottom half of the sandwich, so to speak. Verse 35. While he was still speaking, by the way, this is while who was still speaking? Jesus. While Jesus is still speaking, you know, we don't know what he's saying because Mark doesn't record it, but he is apparently giving a little mini sermon after this woman is healed. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house, Jairus' house, some who said, your daughter is dead. That's the news he did not want to hear. And they say, why trouble the teacher any further? Give up, buddy. Your daughter is dead. You made a good effort. You went out as a synagogue ruler. You may lose your position. You may lose your income. You may lose your reputation because you're a part of the Jewish synagogue. And you just risked everything to come to this person, Jesus. Now we're done. Give up. She's dead. Verse 36. But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. Do not fear, only believe. So we know at a minimum, Jairus at some point on this journey began to fear, right? Began to fear because Jesus was kind of taking his time. Jesus has kind of stopped and help out someone who he could probably say, you could come help her later because I'm more important. Do not fear, only believe. Verse 37, and he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John and the brother of James. Same people at the transfiguration. So in the gospel text, we begin to see that not only does Jesus have his 12 disciples whom he is close to, but he's got kind of an inner circle as well that he is close to. So he takes these three for a very specific lesson. What does this desperate faith look like? For Jairus, we now see that desperate faith looks like believing Jesus in stressful circumstances. Can you imagine being Jairus and being like, come help my daughter? And he says yes, and you're like, woohoo, let's go, you know? But then there's this whole priority interrupt where he stops and helps this woman. And you imagine Jairus' thought process is like, no, what are you talking about? It's a very stressful circumstance. And Jesus says, believe. Don't fear, merely believe. For Jairus, the encouragement is we ought to believe Jesus despite the appearances, despite that it looks like Jesus is distracted, despite that Jesus looks like he is disinterested. God instead works in his time. He is not hurried. We learn the power of delay. So Chuck Swindoll says about this passage is that we learn the power of delay because Jairus' request is on delay. but Jesus is still going to come through. Look at verse 38. They came to the house now of the ruler of the synagogue. This is now Jairus' house. This is literally the intended destination of where the story began. And Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." We're going to come back to that. That's a very interesting line that Jesus says to us. Now look at verse 40. How do they respond? How do these people who are wailing, they're basically professional wailers. They're professional mourners, likely, that were hired. And that sounds kind of weird to us. Like, that's not something that you do whenever you have arrangements to make at a funeral home. Part of the list of things that you can get is not wailers, okay? People aren't going to come to your house. But in this time and in this context, it was probably quite normal because this was how you might announce a death to the community, is that people would hear this and then know. So it's not terribly crazy. However, these people were really good at what they did. Whenever they were hired, the person was surely dead. And so they laughed. Jesus says she's not dead, she's merely sleeping. What does that mean? We're going to get to that. The verse goes on. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. Now, what does Jesus here mean by the child is dead? Right? The child is not dead but sleeping. What does Jesus mean by this? I had to really wrestle with this text quite a bit because the typical commentaries will say that the idea of sleeping is that it is a euphemism for death. And so then you have the confusing phrase that the child is not dead but dead. What does Jesus mean by that? Well, the professional wailers understand him literally to be meaning sleeping. So that's why they laugh at him. But we know in the text that she actually is dead because we're going to see, you can go look at the other accounts, is when she is raised back to life, her spirit comes back to her. So we certainly have Jesus saying the child is not dead, but dead. So sleeping here is a euphemism for dead. So what does that mean? We're going to look at a few texts. But before we do, look also at this one, at these texts. Here's some of the texts where we understand the idea of sleeping being referred to as someone being dead. Daniel chapter 2, verse 2. And many of those who slept in the dust of the earth shall awake. Shall awake. Some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. See, Daniel there is a reference to what? The resurrection. The resurrection of all. 1 Kings 2:10 says, then David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Again, the Old Testament using the word sleep for what? For dead. After saying these things, here in John 11, after saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has what? Has he died? No, he has fallen asleep, but I go to awake him. And perhaps a really strong argument for understanding sleeping being a reference to death is 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 14. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are what? Are asleep, that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, through Jesus, God will bring with him those who have what? Fallen asleep. The point that Jesus is making is this, is that physical death is not final. And I think this really leans into perspective for us. For the unbeliever, when they are at a funeral, death is final. There is no waking up for the person that is in the casket. But for the Christian, for the believer, for the one who has put their faith in Jesus Christ, He raised, so will I. So from the Christian perspective, when we go to a funeral, we look at the casket and we go, ha, they're just asleep. Don't worry. They're going to rise again. Yes, the girl is dead, but from the perspective of Jesus, everyone is asleep, deadly asleep, and they will rise again because his resurrection provides resurrection for all. It's resurrection for some to everlasting life and resurrection for others to contempt that we saw there in Paul's writings. So this is what Jesus has in the back of his mind. Jesus has in the back of his mind that one day there will be no more death. That we will sing and we will talk just like Paul does in 1 Corinthians 15 where he says, death has been swallowed up. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? We will one day proclaim that for all of humanity. So in Jesus' perspective, this little girl, this daughter, she looks like she's dead, but trust me, she's only sleeping. In fact, Jesus is going to demonstrate this and say, rise, my daughter. Rise, and she will be resurrected. So what's this teach us about desperate faith, though? It teaches us this. Believe in Jesus despite the skeptics. Despite the skeptics. Look what the skeptics do. Look what the professional wailers do, the professional mourners do. Jesus comes in and says, she's dead, but she's not really dead because of me. Death is not the final word. I am the final word. That's what Jesus is communicating. And so all the professional wailers go, ha, 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 you're so funny. Ha. We've done this so many times. We know what we're doing. Trust me, she's dead. In our faith, in our desperate faith, do you have skeptics in your life? Do you have skeptics that when you express your belief in Scripture, you express your belief in Jesus Christ, and you talk about the moralities of Scripture. You talk about the ethics of Scripture and how Scripture calls us to live our life and how God has called you to be faithful to Him. And when we express those in this world, sometimes people just laugh, don't they? They say, ha, 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 you silly Christians, yeah. You think you're the only ones. You think Jesus is the only way. You silly Christians, you think that homosexuality is wrong. Ha ha ha. So that your little Bible must be totally wrong. We get skeptics all the time. So our faith continues to call us. And this story is calling Jairus to continue to believe. Can you imagine Jairus, though, walking with Jesus? Jesus just told you, do not fear. Right? Do not fear, but only believe. And you're walking up to your own house and you can hear the people mourning inside because you have professional wailers that have come and they're starting to mourn. Can you believe that he would have to put all that aside and say, I am got to ignore all of the naysayers and all of the skeptics and say, but I believe you, Jesus, because you told me to. Because you told me to. I like Chuck Swindoll's commentary of this passage. He says, for faith to replace our fears, we must steer clear of the naysayers. We must steer clear of the naysayers. Those who don't believe Jesus, those who might mock Jesus, and those who laugh at what Jesus tells us. Stay clear. So what will Jesus do? Let's look at verse 41. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means, little girl, I say to you, arise. Now, Mark does this more often. He's putting there in the text the Aramaic. And that is definitely communicates that this is written to the Roman Christians that are being persecuted in Rome at this time. It has a much more Gentile feel to it. So he tells her, little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began walking. For she was 12 years old of age. Now, I don't know the connection here, but this little girl is 12 years old. And how long did the woman with the bleeding issue have that bleeding issue? 12 years as well. Isn't that interesting? 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with what? Amazement. And he strictly charged them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. And he is charging them to say nothing because they're still in the little room where it was her parents and those few disciples. And those, we've talked about the messianic secret from time to time, and Jesus is continuing to expose that and talk about that because he wants to make sure that people look back and believe in a Jesus, in Jesus who went to the cross and was resurrected. So the full story is not completely out there yet. So when he does a miracle here, he says, now keep it quiet just a little bit. In our desperate faith, we recognize that Jesus is our ultimate authority. That's really the content and the passage that we have here within the story of Mark. Mark has been spending plenty of time to show you and me the authority of Jesus. He showed that Jesus has authority over nature by calming the seas. We see that Jesus has authority to cast out many demons. He has authority to heal a woman who is diseased. He has authority to heal death, to reverse it. So do you trust him? Because he has ultimate authority. Now this story has showed us a lot of desperate faith, hasn't it? A lot of desperate faith that says, Jesus, I trust you. I have faith in you. I come to you with my requests. And all these things are very applicable for us. But I want to show you a more high, show us a, I think the text shows us a more high level view here. And the reason Mark does this thing called sandwiching or bookending is because he wants you now to make a contrast of these people. Here's the great contrast. I found this absolutely fascinating. In our desperate times, we see Jairus is desperate, but he is a male. He is very much honored in this culture because he is religiously a leader. He is named in the story. Jairus is named. He has a family, and he approaches Jesus. He comes to Jesus, not in secrecy, but the woman who is a female, religiously an outcast. Remember, unclean for 12 years, not to her own fault. It's just the nature of her life. And she actually is nameless. And she is alone. And she is sneaking up in secrecy. This great contrast exists within this story to teach us three essential truths of desperation. And that is this. Desperation hits us all. I mean, look at Jairus' life. Jairus, you're a Jewish leader. You're doing all the right things. I mean, when you do all the right things for God, doesn't everything go great? He's in desperation. It doesn't matter. For the woman who is absolutely has every right to be in desperation because she can't even participate in life. Desperation hits the Jairuses of the world and the women of the world with a bleeding issue and a medical issue and everyone else in between. Desperation doesn't care about your status. It doesn't care about your social situation, your economical situation. It does not care. We all have desperate times in our life. And we all know others who can go through desperate times as well. So secondly, though, there are no advantages. There are no advantages. This is more within the Jairus story because you would think as a religious leader, you would think maybe I've got some advantages. But he doesn't. He is suffering in a desperation like anyone else. But for the woman who is medically suffering, she may have seen it as a hopeless situation and just given up. She may have thought to herself, like, this is too big of an issue, too big of a deal. I can't even go see this guy. How could he help me at all? That's too big of a barrier. Can't do it. This great contrast teaches us that it doesn't matter what advantages you think you have. It doesn't matter what kind of barriers you think you have. Jesus can overcome both when we come to him in desperation and in need. I finish with this. David Garland summarizes this whole passage wonderfully. He says, dovetailing together the stories of the two such desperate individuals conveys that neither being male, ritually pure, religiously well-regarded, nor having means provides any advantage in approaching Jesus. being female, impure, dishonored, and destitute does not present insurmountable barriers that prevent Jesus from helping. Both of these extremes, Jesus can be there when we express our faith in desperation. So the question I have this morning is, what are you desperate for? What are you desperate for? Is the Christian faith one of desperation for you, or is it one of just going through the motions? Is the Christian faith one that impacts your world and in your life, or is it just a list of do's and don'ts? This is for those who really need God, who need Jesus to make a difference in our lives. And so my encouragement today, if you find yourself in desperation, come to Jesus in faith. If you don't find yourself in desperation for Jesus, then start praying, because I don't think you realize how much we need him.